Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. If you are a regular listener to this show, I would put money on you having read and loved at least one novel by Julia Glass. She is author of seven novels, among them Three Junes, winner of the National Book Award, and I See You Everywhere, winner of the Binghamton University John Gardner Fiction Book Award. A recipient of fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the New York Foundation of the Arts, and the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study, Glass is a distinguished writer in residence at Emerson College. Today, Julia and I will be discussing her latest novel, Vigil Harbor, a story of the near future in which many of our current crises are amplified in terrifying yet recognizable ways. The COVID pandemic and its after effects are still felt. Coastal communities are being swept into the sea. A violent wave of xenophobia and anti-immigrant, anti-refugee sentiment stokes fires everywhere. Such is the world a little more than a decade from now in Julia's imaginings. Like so many of Julia's works of fiction, it is the voices of the characters that populate this world that make the novel sing. There's the architect, Austin Kepner, who obsesses over building houses that are made to withstand the furies of an angry planet's weather. Margot, the sardonic, brainy teacher. Brecht, home from NYU after escaping a domestic terror attack, and so many other unique and compelling voices. Life in the small coastal town of Vigil Harbor is awakened by two visitors, one a stranger and the other well known to certain inhabitants. The result is a novel of many pleasures that unsettles even as it delights. It is such a pleasure to welcome the incomparable Julia Glass.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. Julia, you care a great deal about geography in your fiction, and particularly human life in coastal areas. In Vigil Harbor, that attention to place becomes its own character, with the changes of climate threatening to demolish a way of life by the ocean. Can you talk about your relationship to place in your novels? And did that relationship change at all with Vigil Harbor?
That's a good question, Chris. First of all, I'd like to refer to this as an autogeographical novel as opposed to an autobiographical novel. Vigil Harbor is absolutely based on the town that I live in north of Boston, which is called Marblehead. And like Vigil Harbor, it's a rocky peninsula that sort of shuts out into the Atlantic Ocean. It has a long, colorful history related to the establishment of colonies in the 17th century. It was originally a cod fishing village, and then also had played a very important role in the American Revolution because those cod fishermen became the Marblehead Mariners, who were George Washington's Navy. And the fortunes of my town, Marblehead, in the years after the Revolution actually took a steep dive, and as a result, it's been preserved as a town. Now it's quite affluent, as Vigil Harbor is in this novel. It's a very privileged, mostly white, mostly liberal town, but with a strong sense of New England identity. I mean, you'll meet people here who are proud to be 12th generation Marbleheaders. So as I like to tell people in town here who are reading the book, if you find yourself in the book, you have a greater imagination than I do, because I did not. This is not a roman à clé about our dicey town politics or local scandals. In fact, today is voting day for many local offices. So We have a strong sense of a local political identity too. But if I talk in a larger sense about place, every fiction writer takes greater pleasure in one part of creating their stories than another. You know, it may be plotting, it may be dialogue. But for me, the greatest pleasure when I'm writing a book is putting the reader in a place. And that place may be a house, a landscape, you know, a community. But that's where, you know, I feel most at home. And I think it's partly because, you know, I wherever I've lived, whether it's Massachusetts or New England or here in Paris, I'm very alive and attentive to the place I'm in. And, you know, through my 20s, I was actually a painter. I didn't really start seriously writing fiction until my 30s. And I think it has to do also with my visual sense, that I really, really look at the world around me. And I love to convey that in my fiction. And, you know, before I started writing fiction, I read so much fiction in my years as a painter. And I think that many of the writers I love the most are those for whom place exerts a very strong force on their characters' lives, whether it was, you know, Thomas Hardy or Jim Harrison or Alice Munro. Of course, there's Faulkner, too. And writers who revisit places over and over again, as I do both New York and New England, and coastal New England in particular.
It makes so much sense now to learn that you are a visual artist first, because these places feel very painted and very, you take care with the textures and details of place. And it's very clear that that's where the pleasure center lies for you, because it's so carefully shown. I have to say, I love, there's a little dig against this idea of New England longevity in a place in your novel. I forget the exact quote. You can remind me, but a character basically says, why is it important that somebody lived, you know, has generations who've lived here before them?
Well, you know, I think my father, who had a wonderful wry sense of humor, my mother used to joke that she, and my mother grew up on this Showcase dairy farm, but she would joke that she married my father for two things: his teeth and his pedigree. And because my father, you know, and hence I can trace our ancestry back to John Alden and Priscilla Mullins, who came over on the Mayflower. So my mother was so proud that she'd married a descendant of the Mayflower. My father used to say to me, "I don't see why there's anything to be proud of having ancestors who had to risk their lives to cross an ocean because they were such social misfits, you know." and likewise, you know, the original settlers of Marblehead were these hard scrabble libertarian, very poor fishermen who lived in, you know, barrels before they could build houses. And it's like, really? You know, you would want to stay in a place like this forever and ever and not improve your fortunes? So, that is a bit of a joke.
And I also love that you have a version of that line about marrying someone for their teeth, but I think it's teeth and vocabulary in this one.
Oh, yes, you're right. I did use that.
I think it's a fabulous
Largo
line.
Right.
There's a famous quote from our mutual friend, the Dickens novel, about reading the police blotter. He do the police in different voices. And it came to mind when I was reading this novel, your care for voice and for differentiating characters by the uniqueness of their language makes this novel and your fiction special. I think writers today often trade sometimes the uniqueness of a character's voice for a general vibe or ambiance of their style overall. How did you work to differentiate the many voices that populate this novel?
So, you know, I teach, you do too. I mean, I teach creative writing in an MFA program. And one thing that I say is, you know, it's okay if when you're writing a first draft, everybody sounds just like you. And that's really, in truth, in most cases, when I'm writing at the beginning, everybody sounds like me. But as I revise, as I go back and back and back and back, I think very hard about very mundane things like my character's education, you know, where they grew up. And you know, their, and not just their personality. I mean, how there are times when I've had to, I hate using this expression, but it's the handy expression, to sort of dumb down a character's vocabulary, because character is not, you know, is not some Ivy schooled, you know, literature loving, library haunting person like me. So, but in this case, you know, one of the most interesting characters for me to work with, and I had to work very hard, in part because he became more important than I thought he would be, is the young man Brecht in this, whose voice is the first one you hear. And, you know, as you know, Vigil Harbor is narrated by 8 characters plus an omniscient narrator who comes in occasionally to sort of set the larger scene. But it is Brecht who begins this story. And he is a 21-year-old young man who has come home to Vigil Harbor from New York City, where he was in college, until he escaped, just barely survived a very violent act. And as, I mean, I don't know that you've mentioned this yet, but Vigil Harbor is set 12 years in the future. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that occurred to me is that it is in the mouths of our teenagers and our, you know, our young people that language evolves the most quickly. I'm sure you, you know, it's that you mentioned you have a teenager. I'm sure you've heard brand new adjectives or adjectives used in different ways. And so one of the challenges for me was to have Brecht speak in a very slightly futuristic way, to have new slang. And most of the other characters are middle-aged and are older, but and so the reader will encounter at the beginning some unfamiliar uses of familiar words. It's not something you have to work very hard to understand, but I'm glad that that's something that I really took time to think about. And that makes him very individual. But also there's, and Margot, you and I spoke a little bit. Margot is a character who is very feisty, very smart. She's a retired English teacher, but she's also very angry. And that anger comes through in the way she speaks.
Yes. And in fact, I was hoping that you would read a little section of Margot, because I love her voice maybe best.
Thank you.
And maybe it's the fact that we both share teaching as an occupation, but there's something about the wry and witty and kind of book smart teacher who's also a little world weary that I love about her. And she's so sort of sharp and sharp tongued. So there's a little hilarious section where she's almost kind of thinking through her own way of speaking. And I wonder if you'd just read that one paragraph for me.
So which is it? Do you want me to read the paragraph that begins "to hell with"?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So she has, her husband has left her. And this is a scandal that helps set off the story. So she has just gone shopping and decided that, you know, even though she's now alone because she's an empty nester in her house, she's just going to go ahead and make a big grocery run. And so this is what she's thinking after she brings the groceries home. "To hell with smaller quantities," I decided, "with shopping like a spinster sparrow. One of our guilty, extravagant pleasures and a blessing during times of plague was always the basement freezer, the sort of wattage guzzling colossus used by modern frontiersmen to store an entire elk, or by mass murderers to hoard and preserve the remains of missing teenagers. I can tell you this, Tom is going to pine for my gritty sense of humor, the chief side effect of having to police my own mouth all day, 5 days a week, in a public school with eyes and ears in every room, temperature sensors at the entrance, and bulletproof glass in the windows. Tom said he could always tell when I'd spent the day teaching Dickinson or Wordsworth or Billy fucking Lanyard Collins, because my language was spicier and my taste in movies crude. Not that we don't all revere the curiously immortal Miss Emily, at least in moderate doses."
That's wonderful, and I find it so evocative of her character. And there's such a lot in that one paragraph, where we get a sense of, okay, this is a world that still has a kind of lingering sense of the pandemic. There's I was very struck in rereading this passage by the bulletproof glass, as we are, you know, considering in many ways our schools and the how gun violence has just absolutely destroyed the idea of them as places of safety. And in this world, in Vigil Harbor's world, you know, safety in every feature of life is in some way thrown asunder. But there's also the hilarious reference to Billy Collins' famous poem, The Lanyard, about his love for his mother, which is, you know, yeah, there's lots to say about that. But we get a sense of Margot very strongly in even just that one description. I wonder, in, you know, since clearly you were writing this for many years before our moment, but obviously writing it in the midst of COVID, what did it feel like to broach COVID in the novel? I know a lot of writers feel really kind of unsure about how that can live in their novels.
Well, absolutely, but I should tell you that I had, in fact, basically finished a pretty polished draft in early 2020. So I had the challenge of putting COVID into a novel that I had basically completed, which was incredibly hard to do. Mm. And at first I was just very pessimistic about being able to have that happen. But I should go back and say that this novel, normally I work on one novel at a time. And, you know, my joke is I'm a serial monogamist, and, you know, I work with one set of characters until publication do us part. And only when I let the book go into the pipeline at the publisher do I start to write the next book. So, but what happened was I was working on this book in, I'm going to say, 2012, 2013. And I, for various reasons I won't go into, I got stuck. And I'd written about 150 pages maybe. And suddenly I started to think about another set of characters. And I have to tell you, it felt literally like I was having an affair. I mean, I felt so guilty. I had this little file folder in the corner of my desktop that I'd say, now you can't go to there, you know, but I'd sneak over. I'd say, okay, only 10 minutes. And these other characters were a British movie star, the assistant to a famous children's book author, and a museum curator. And they are the principal characters of my last novel, A House Among the Trees. So in other words, I set Vigil Harbor aside for a couple of years, totally. And when A House Among the Trees was published, the world had changed a great deal. It was 2017. And it was in June of 2017 that our relatively new president withdrew us from the Paris Climate Accord. And also it was 2017 in which, among 17 named storms, 10 of which were hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, and Maria devastated the Gulf Coast and, of course, Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And so here I had been. I thought, am I going back to this novel that's set in this coastal town? And at that time, the principal character was Austin, the architect, who builds houses designed to withstand extreme weather on the coast. But I thought, you know, this is what crossed my mind, Chris. I thought, you know, what does it mean in this moment to be a climate activist, someone, you know, advocating and trying to legislate for changes that will help us address climate change, or even climate scientists, in a world and under a government that just couldn't care less? I thought, what would happen if, in order to be heard, those people became violent, that they enacted that climate activism became a form of terrorism? And that is where suddenly I decided I wanted to set this book just enough in the future that the volume is turned up on all the things that we have so much anxiety about: political divisiveness, immigration policy, reproductive rights, but in the foreground, You know, what does it mean to fight for, to fight against climate change, to try to make anything happen? And so, although it is not at all in my normal wheelhouse to be a speculative writer, to write about the supernatural or the paranormal or the dystopian, I thought I can write about a world that is still recognizable, at least the immediate world. It's still a Julia Glass novel that's very much about family and family relationships and friendships and the importance of community. But things are going to be a little more dire. And I'm also, of course, writing about a community that regards itself as fairly insulated from the changes of the larger world. And of course, that's a complete illusion, as the novel shows, as you know, you alluded to, because those dire issues and the violence sort of begotten by them come to town in a very dramatic way. But I am not writing about a world that has been, you know, nuked to the ground or back into the Stone Age, or this is not, and this is certainly not science fiction. You know, I'm pretty timid about the changes in technology that I create in this book. So there I was. Finally, I clicked into what I wanted to do with this. I just about, you know, done with a polished draft, March 2020. And I'm, you know, I won't say the expletives that went into my head, but I, you know, you can imagine. I sounded a lot like Margot. And I just thought, how can I do this? And because here's the thing, you know, the closer the future you write about, the narrower your margin of error. Because COVID, and at that point, you know, who knew what was going to happen? Was it going to take 5 years to get a vaccine, as Anthony Fauci warned us back in 2020? Was it, you know, but I thought, I'm going to go with the idea that we don't get entirely through COVID, but we get to a better place. And then I thought to myself, I'm in all my novels, you, the reader, go very deep into every important character's past. I mean, each of my characters is like a deep well. And so I had already been depicting various hardships and losses and ordeals that my characters had already been through. And then I thought, well, what was it like for each of them to go through the experience of those first years of COVID? And so then that's how I was able to go back into the novel and to put COVID into it. And I think it doesn't feel shoehorned in. I mean, my editor said, you know, it actually feels, because she'd read a draft before, she said COVID gave a kind of scaffolding to the world that I'm writing about here. You know, that the world had been through, you know, this global crisis and huge mortality event, if that's what we call it, so many deaths. So it ended up working out, I think, but it had to be pushed in later.
I don't find it heavy-handed, and it felt important, and I agree with the idea of it being scaffolding. But you also anticipated my question about the idea of a climate change novel. And when I had Ruman Alam on the show, he made the argument that all fiction now is climate fiction, whether it thinks of itself as such. But then when I put that same premise to Alexandra Kleeman, she argued that while that might be right, we need better ways of talking about the coming disaster in that fiction. And Vigil Harbor, I think, takes a chance with that and says, as you say, let's not begin with the world is razed to ashes, but let's think about what life in particularly dire times looks like, and how do you still have, you know, loves, losses, relationships, ways of being, building community, things like that. Is that something you were thinking through when you were imagining all of a sudden, oh, I'm writing a climate novel?
Well, you know, first of all, I never thought I'm writing a climate novel. And you know, I like to joke that it's very important while writing a novel that I remain sort of stupid to a certain degree. In other words, that I'm not entirely aware of what it is I'm doing. Because even though the notion of foregrounding climate activism was in my mind, I didn't think, oh, I'm writing about climate change per se. I mean, it's hard to explain that. But the first interview I did for this book, which was a couple months before it came out, was with Publishers Weekly, and it was for a roundup of 7 climate change novels, Cli-Fi, you know, it's called, coming out in the spring. And my publicist, I said, and I sort of bristled and said, this isn't Cli-Fi. But the more I talk about the book now that it's out, the more I realize that I just, okay, it's like, you know, accept this, accept the reality that that's really what you wanted to write about. And and also, I think that part of it is that I take for granted that living on a coast, the weather, the climate and the weather are always at the forefront of what people talk about, what, you know, the tides. I mean, literally, you know, knowing when high tide and low tide are important at various times, what the wind is doing. This is a town of sailors. I am not a sailor, but I'm happy to be ballast on your sailboat if we don't go anywhere too far out of the harbor. But you know, so climate is a huge topic of conversation, and not necessarily in an apocalyptic way when you live in a coastal town. So there's that. But I also want to say that I don't think that I will ever write a novel that doesn't have a hopeful ending. And I realize that's a double negative. But one of the challenges for me was to be honest about how I feel about some of the things that we are, you know, some of the disasters that we are potentially headed toward. There's no doubt about that in my mind, but also feeling that there is reason to be optimistic, perhaps not on all fronts, but on some fronts. And when I created a character, and that character is Mike, who's a marine biologist, whose work is, you know, trying to restore and save the beautiful salt marshes of the North Shore here in Massachusetts, which I believe are the largest contiguous salt marshes remaining on the East Coast, many others having been absolutely destroyed either by development or by, in the case of the Gulf Coast, the oil industry. And sometimes it's thankless work. I actually went to some lectures and did some research on that while I was writing the novel. So naturally you have someone here, a marine biologist, whose work is somewhat punishing in truth. Mm-hmm. At one point he makes the sort of grim joke that he's in marine hospice is his profession. Oh. And of course that's the worst possible picture, but I'm also a believer that people are very ingenious and enterprising and adaptive. I actually read a really wonderful editorial in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago by Ezra Klein, and it's called "Your Kids Are Not Doomed," and it's about this. It's about in part why, even though we have to face realities, and there's a lot that we can't reverse in the damages we've done, there's also reason to be hopeful, not to give up. So that's the stance I wanted to take.
Yeah, Alexandra Kleeman makes a similar point, I think, in saying that, you know, by having hope within desperate situations, that you don't allow people, the writer included, to then sort of just roll over and go into the fetal position. Because if it's all hopeless, then that's where people will start to move toward. But rather, climate fiction can take the place of offering glimpses of hope that may make us into different kinds of activists.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You know, I do think, though, that it's that there's also a very important place for fiction that shows the worst case scenario. And I'll tell you, you know, when I was a child, I worked at my public library. You can actually start working as a paid page in fifth grade, which nowadays is considered, you know, illegal child labor. And I read a lot of books way too young. Some of them erotic and some of them just really terrifying. And I'll never forget reading On the Beach by Neville Shute. Now, so mind you, this is in the 1960s and early 70s. This is, you know, high Cold War.
And
the thing
novel
that everybody was the most afraid of was all-out nuclear warfare. And of course, now, thank you, Vladimir Putin, we're thinking about that one again.
Yeah.
But I read that book, and that is about the last few people alive after a major apocalyptic worldwide nuclear strike, you know, on a beach in Australia. And they're all dying of radiation sickness. And
it's a cheery novel.
Yeah, that's important too. I mean, I think we have to, and by the way, a novel that I read last fall that came out last fall, 2034 by Elliot Ackerman, and you know, the much decorated Iraq and Afghanistan veteran who's a fiction writer, that he co-wrote with Admiral Stavridis. And the reason I read it, well, first of all, I heard a great interview with Elliot Ackerman on NPR, but that 2034 is in fact the year that Vigil Harbor takes place in. I mean, it doesn't say so, but if you do the math, it takes place in spring of 2034. Well, the novel 2034 imagines that that's the year we enter World War III. And it's quite a suspenseful, and, you know, it doesn't end in the destruction of the entire world, but nuclear bombs are launched. And I thought to myself, well, you know, if my characters in Vigil Harbor, you know, if this was the world they were living in, they'd have bigger problems than the ones they're worried about in the course of my book. But you see, I don't feel that Elliot Ackerman or I am setting out to predict that this is what that year will look like. We're saying, look at what might happen to us, you know, and he's thinking about warfare and diplomacy and the military games that we play worldwide. And I'm thinking about, the politics of climate and also the way politics divide people, because they're, you know, in the world that I'm writing about, there's a spin-off political party called the End Timers, and that enters into the plot line a little bit too.
Mm-hmm. Without giving too much away, one of the central plot elements of the novel is the arrival of a visitor to the coastal community. But visitation and hospitality, how individuals and communities treat strangers, is a crucial aspect at the heart of Vigil Harbor. Can you say a little bit about what you were doing with the idea of the stranger or the visitor in this novel?
Well, first of all, I don't know if it was Stephen King, but some writer once said, you know, there are only two kinds of plots. One is a stranger comes to town, and the other is someone leaves town. You know, leave town, come to town, whatever. And in a way, that's true. So there are actually two strangers who come to town in Vigil Harbor, separately. And one of them is bent on revenge, uncovering a secret in the past life of the architect, who's an important character. And the other one, the one you're alluding to, is someone, and I can't give too much away, who is very charming and presents himself in a light that I think the reader can suspect is not the entire truth. And it is his arrival in town that is going to unleash that's going to put a number of the characters in danger. But the thing about Vigil Harbor, and this is how the book begins with an omniscient voice talking about what does it mean to live on a peninsula? If you choose to live on what is essentially a cul-de-sac, it means that nobody really ever comes through town. And that's true about the town I live in. You don't have people coming through town going, oh my God, I'm so totally lost. How do I find such and such? I mean, unless they really got off the GPS. And I mean, in fact, it's very hard to get to this town. And once you're in this town, because there are all these little colonial one-way streets, it's very hard to get out of this town. And I my joke is that we're basically Brigadoon. But it means that everybody knows everybody. And I'll tell you that during the summer of 2020, you know, high COVID, pre-vaccination, it became very apparent that a lot of people had sort of discovered my town, that we're taking day trips out from Boston, and that, you know, your favorite little rocky cove where you'd go swimming, suddenly there's someone you know isn't from town. And often when you live in a town like this, you have this kind of, you know, obnoxiously defensive feel like, hey, that's my beach. Who are you? And you think, no, in fact, I live in this really beautiful place. And why shouldn't we share this town that we live in? So So there is that sense of insularity that's quite contagious. And there's also, you know, in this novel, another very important character who actually comes, he was a major character in my novel, The Widower's Tale, is Celestino, who is Guatemalan. He's been in this country for decades. He came as a teenager, and he's married to a woman who grew up in Vigil Harbor. And yet, even so, he still feels not only like a kind of outsider, he has a successful landscaping business, but he actually still feels that his status is not that secure. The sense that at any moment, things could really go south and he could end up, you know, being deported somehow. And his wife, of course, doesn't completely understand that, but he is crucial to the plot line with the stranger coming to town.
Yes, and I thought that the way that immigration and how climate change pushes and will inevitably push on the sort of xenophobic lizard brains of yes. of people as they see that the climate is going to cause this refugee crisis, and you have immigration take a really sort of horrible turn, and one that echoes a lot of what happened under the Trump administration, but forecasts much worse things to come. Right. And I wonder if, as you were thinking about Celestino and his kind of discomfort in not knowing his place, whether you were thinking at all about, you know, what the future might look like when we have to have a very new sense of what an immigrant is, who an immigrant is.
You know, a friend of mine here in town has worked very hard helping some Afghan families who were brought out of Afghanistan by our government to settle in this area. And she's seen some pretty surprising xenophobia among very liberal people. I mean, you know, if you live in an affluent, white, privileged town, which is what this mostly is. In fact, my husband's joke about the town we live in, and this was, we moved from New York City here. He says that diversity is represented by brunettes. which is kind of true. So I think we've raised very liberal-minded children who've gone out into the world and so forth. But you're right. There is a kind of lizard brain, you know, sort of knee-jerk us versus them thing that happens. And one of the things that I know, I mean, I shouldn't say I know, but I'm quite confident is going to be one of the biggest challenges that will happen, no matter what efforts we can miraculously pull together on climate change, is there are places like the Marshall Islands, let's say, that are inevitably going to be underwater. That's just a fact. And so the question is, how generous are those of us who are, you know, who, as I like to say, have accidentally won the geopolitical or the geographical lottery in terms of where we are, you know, how welcoming are we going to be? Are we willing to be? And I think that is going to be one of the first challenges of what climate change is doing in the near future is, you know, is bringing people in who have nowhere to live or nothing to eat. You know, we're going to face agricultural challenges too, but, you know, that's something I'm thinking about. I actually, an event I did for this book a month ago at a very fancy sort of country club, and it was a wonderfully well-attended event. You know, lots of, it was kind of like a ladies' lunch and very smart readers, lots of book clubs. But when I went to sign books, this woman came rushing up to my table and said, "I want you to know that I'm a climate refugee." And she was this beautifully dressed, well-coiffed and manicured woman. And I said, "Oh," and she said that she had to evacuate her town in Napa, you know, twice because of the wildfires.
Oh, the fires, that was enough. Yeah.
So she said, "That was it. So I've moved to the East Coast. So I just wanted you to know that I am a climate refugee." And I thought, well, you know, yes, she is, but that's not what I'm thinking about.
Napa wasn't, you know, primary in your mind when you were.
but you look at California. I mean, I've got a child, early 20s, who wants to work in an industry that's based in Los Angeles. And I'm thinking, no, not California. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we can also. So here's the thing, you know, living in New England, and you know, you're also in the Northeast roughly. I mean, we feel pretty, we're not likely to have wildfires. We're not likely to be square center of a hurricane. Once in a while, yes, that happens. We're not prone to a lot of tornadoes. I mean, at the moment, as far as weather goes and climate, you know, it's not going to be 120 degrees, you know, but at the same time, we are not shut off from domino effects. I mean, we are also very lucky in our water supply. I mean, I read about the future of water supply in the Southwest, and it just makes no sense to me that people are still moving there. But we don't need to go into talking about that. But there is a way in which I feel, at least for now, quite fortunate in terms of where I live. Because if it's 105 degrees a couple days in a row this summer, you know, I can deal with that. So.
Yeah, but you're so right that the domino effect is going to, it will affect everyone, no matter mm-hmm. where they are. And yeah. having water and having slightly more temperate temperatures will mean that we will have inevitably people coming and needing space and needing housing. And I think of, you know, even back to epic literature, the Odyssey, the question of how will you be hospitable to the stranger who comes, who needs those kinds of things, who needs food and shelter. And in the United States, we seem ill-equipped to do the kind of imagining required for how we will change our notion of property and ownership and belonging and community. And I feel hopeful that maybe fiction is a place that can help us start that imagining.
Yes, absolutely. Or even just talking. You know, the other thing what I like to say is, a book can't change the world, but readers of books can change the world. Mm-hmm. And if mm-hmm. a book starts a conversation about something that needs to be changed, and if that book is fiction, you know, it can be just as powerful as nonfiction. And also, I think that we've been living in a time like this for a while, but particularly since the onset of COVID, we are overwhelmed with news. I mean, you know, add Ukraine, you know, to and add, you know, the school shootings and the January 6th hearings. I mean, the weight of the news really honestly feels like it just gets heavier and heavier. And if so there's true. A way to not stick our heads in the sand, but to read about and think about where the world is headed that is not through the news, then that can be regenerative, I think.
And I love that idea of it's not the book, but it's the readers of a book who will make the change. You've been praised as a novelist of rich characters and driving plots. In an age of autofiction and brooding, sometimes plotless novels, who are the writers you turn to for well-plotted character studies?
You know, I cut my teeth teeth as a reader plot-wise on the 19th century, you know, the masterpiece theater authors, you know, George Eliot and Thomas Hardy and so forth. But I'm just going to name a few contemporary writers who have, a book has to have for me depth of characters, you know, as well as richness of plot. And Stuart Onan is someone who is a perennial favorite of mine. And he's capable of writing really plot-driven, you know, even sometimes sort of dark, thrillery kinds of books. And then he can also write these very deeply character-focused novels. So he's someone I'm a big admirer of, and he has a new novel out now called Ocean State. Jim Harrison, who I named earlier, I mean, he's no longer with us, but he was very influential to me, I think. And you know, many people have said to me, oh my God, he's such a man's writer. Hmm. But the thing I loved about Jim Harrison's books is that there are always moral consequences for his bad boys. You know, his novels are full of womanizing, you know, drunk men doing very foolish things. But there's always a price to be paid, and consequences are important. You know, I'm really coming to discover and love James Baldwin. I'm ashamed that I hadn't before. You know, I just read If Beale Street Could Talk, or Could Speak, is it?
Speak, and
I
yeah. just,
and I could not put that down. Tara Jones is another writer I really love. Can't wait for her next one to come out. Jennifer Egan is a magician. I mean, it's like every one of her books is different, and I'm really excited about reading her new one. Mm-hmm. But I also want to mention a novelist who I read almost all of her novels, and that is quite a lot of novels when I was a painter, and that's Iris Murdoch. And I think that Iris Murdoch is due to be rediscovered. She's been a little bit in eclipse, and I'm not quite sure why, but I was absolutely in love with her and her rich plot. They're almost overstuffed, her novels. I mean, she really pushes the envelope on plot, on coincidence, on destiny. But I love her characters, love her novels. And when I look back, I think that she may have had, even though I read all these books before I really turned to writing fiction, I think that she had a large influence on the amount that I'm willing to sort of bite off, because I love to populate a novel, not to the extent of War and Peace perhaps, but I think that I'm pretty good at choreographing all the characters too. And I want to add that one of the sort of surprise pleasures I've had is the audiobook for Vigil Harbor. There are 9, and I'm going to mention it because I'm not a listener of audiobooks, but I often have people come up to me at events and say, oh, I just listened to the audiobook of this or that, and I loved it. And this one, there are 9 performers. And so I actually listened to samplings of all of them. I helped choose the cast members in some cases, but it's really a very rich listen as opposed to a rich read. And I really want to, of course, I'm here to promote my own book, but I also want to say that if people who are audiobook listeners, I think this one is particularly pleasurable.
I'm excited about that because the last one I read with such a full cast was really wonderful too. George Saunders' Lincoln and the Bardo has an incredible cast of voice actors. And so I'll have to, I'd love to listen to this on audiobook as well.
Yeah, I can also say, and this isn't my 26-year-old son reads one of the lesser characters. He reads Egon, the son.
Oh my gosh!
Had to audition for it. I mean, he's an actor. He had to audition for it, and he had to do two. And I just like let him do, and he's in it. And I listened with some trepidation, and when I was listening to him, to his part of the book, my husband was working in the yard. His father and I was sitting in the kitchen, just listening with awe to my son read words that I had written. And he doesn't read my books, by the way, because, you know, you never know when you might encounter a sex scene written by your mother, and that would be horrible. But his father came into the kitchen, and I just looked at him like, oh my God, can you believe this? And he looked at me as if, to say, "What?" I said, "It's Alec, our son." And he did not recognize our son's voice. Why? Because our son is acting. And I hadn't, I knew he'd been cast. Anyway, so it was fun. But there's a nice variety. Margot is hilarious, the sort of feisty character I read from. So, I'm very, very pleased with that production.
Well, I can't wait to listen to it, and I can't wait for my listeners to pick up Vigil Harbor, because they will not be disappointed. And I want to thank you for such a rich and wonderful conversation about your work.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure. And I'm so glad to discover your podcast, too.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, that's all from me for now. My great thanks to Julia Glass. You'll find her recommendations for novels with driving plots and extraordinary characters at our website, burnedbybooks.com, where you can also purchase Vigil Harbor and listen to all of our previous episodes. Thank you, as always, for listening. Do leave a rating if you have a moment, as it does help us bring in new listeners. There are exciting shows coming up this summer. Rachel Krantz, Alice Elliott Dark, and hold the phone, Mohsen Hamid. But until then, this has been Burned by Books.